Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And my name's Chris Jackson. I've just been speaking with Fred about some things I've been writing of late in regard to emerging technologies. It's, I was inspired by to write these things based on my recent experiences with helping some people out in the small satellite industry.
Well, you get involved with these companies trying new technologies a bunch. But that was part of what you did at UCLA too, wasn't it? Dealing with the risk of really the cutting edge things, and from autonomous vehicles to small satellites to what else did you get into?
Well, yeah, autonomous vehicles was a big thing. I set up a center for the safety and reliability of autonomous systems, not just vehicles. And I suppose it's a good thing to talk about when we're talking about emerging technologies, is because it's happening all around us. It truly is an emerging technology. And if you listen to the news, people are scared.
Well, yeah, I remember people were scared that we're all going to lose our jobs to robots and automation and everything else. And it turns out, I saw a study the other day, it says there's actually more jobs now because of automation. They're just different jobs than factory work, essentially.
I did say, if you listen to the news.
That's right. That's right. What was the other one? A couple of years ago, it was delivery drones. Has that showed up anywhere?
Starting to. I think Amazon's starting to do some of these delivery drone like activities, and the military have done it without advertising it too much. As well, they are less bound by regulation, which is not a criticism, it's just
they just shoot at you if you disagree.
That's
with
right.
Yep.
You have an immediate feedback on your risk profile, suffice to say.
That's right. Yeah, but before, I want to talk about, I had the privilege of looking through your article, and I'm really looking forward to getting them out. I know you got a little bit more work to do on them, so, but I think you've got one published. By the time this podcast goes live, you'll have a couple of those articles published, and, but before we dive into that, because I think it was a pretty interesting read, let's take a short break for one of our messages.
Hi, this is Adam Barrett. I just wanted to take a moment to thank Minitab Software for their support of Apex Ridge Reliability and the Ascendo community. If you'd like to learn more about their statistical software packages, please go to ascendoreliability.com/go/Minitab.
All right, Chris. So we just got back from this, onto this topic. We whetted the appetite a little bit, and you've written, I believe it's going to be 7 articles altogether. A couple of them are posted now and available. But what would you say is the main message, or can you summarize it in just a couple sentences, what this is all about?
Yeah, absolutely. The series argues that critical thinking needs to replace compliance. That's as much as you want to say about it. That's essentially what we're arguing. We can go into greater detail about that too.
Well, it's not just reliability engineers, though. When I hear that, I see that in all kinds of disciplines.
Absolutely.
Right. In some places, it's appropriate. Compliance is what you expect and what you need and what you're driving for. Yet, at the checker at the grocery store, if the bananas cost $1.98, then it should be a process that she follows that we actually get $1.98 charge.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So compliance there is good enough, is expected. Now, there's an analogy, though, is that if she can speed up the process or is sociable or remembers our name, and all of those other parts are not necessarily parts of compliance. They're beyond that. And that's part of the thinking part I think you're getting at. Using a simple example of this, even a job like the checkout at a grocery store. But you've had checkers and stores that they remember your favorite beverage and they have it ready for you, or they greet you by name and not trying to read it off of the receipt, or just a bit more to being there than just complying with their duties.
Yeah. And I suppose I should be, you know, if I was to expand on what I said, that, you know, critical thinking needs to replace compliance, maybe a more apt way of saying that is compliance needs to be subservient or junior to critical thinking. There's always a place for compliance and making sure the bananas that are stated that the amount of bananas which it cost $1.98 is reflected on your credit card charge. There's nothing wrong with the compliance approach and making sure that process works.
But there's a larger problem to be solved though, right? It's getting repeat customers to have an experience that the customer looks forward to and comes back to. And applying that to engineers is there's generally some problem we're trying to solve. We're trying to create a system or design a product or whatever that requires critical thinking. Yet when it comes to reliability, which we got to bring it back to that at some point, Chris, just pulling out the checklist of, well, here's the 47 tests that we always run, that really doesn't serve anybody. It's not really helping anybody. It's not, you avoided having to think about it, but that's the problem. And I think that's the gist of what you're getting at here.
Yeah, and the main characteristic of compliance is it's backwards looking. It's based on what has happened in the past. Mm-hmm. So that's the first issue. The second issue is it's actually not just the past. It's actually the distant past. The reason why is because human beings in society take a long time for our consensus-driven approach to standards and regulatory frameworks to see new ideas trickle down to that checklist. So the thing you need to comply with is not only backwards looking, it's backwards looking from 5 years ago, because that's when the last standards committee, the last regulatory framework body sat down to discuss these things.
Yes. And, yeah, I have to laugh here, Chris, because it's in spades. I saw this once with a nice little startup company that was doing really well. They were growing customer list and had a wonderful product, very efficient. I'm drawing a blank on what they're called, but it was a gallium arsenic based solar power generation device, and it used big collectors. They would put 1,000 sun equivalent into this chip, and it was very, very efficient at converting to electricity. And they were involved with the standards committee, and the standards committee wanted them to expose their chips before they're encapsulated to a high humidity test. And I said, well, that'll destroy them. You don't need to test that. It's like hitting it with a sledgehammer. You know it's going to break it. And it'll never be exposed to humidity when you encapsulate it. If you're testing it with the encapsulant, then humidity test makes sense. But no, and he was like, no. And he had to show it to me on paper. The draft was an 85% RH at 85 Celsius for 100 hours, or was it 1,000 hours? And I said, it'll fail in about 3 minutes. He goes, yeah, I know. But no, the committee said that that's the required test if we're going to do this and blah, blah, blah. And they went on and on and on. And I'm like, you know, it's not just 5 years.
You're saying, what, maybe 10, 20, 30, 50?
Yeah, there's resistance to change in general, right? Mm-hmm. And so now you got a new product, a new idea, new technology, whatever. So there's a barrier just to, will this actually solve my problem? You're kind of counting on early adopters, people trying those things out, and you can capitalize on that. Getting it into the market is a whole different topic, right? And getting it in, accepted in the market, like drones or autonomous vehicles, all those things. That's a bigger problem than reliability, of which reliability of the performance of the product plays a role, a factor of it, right? Mm-hmm. If a drone suddenly loses one of its motors and it drops out of the sky and crashes through your fence, that's a problem.
And it's a huge problem, yeah.
Right. And making a durable, reliable system such that it doesn't do that is part of that larger problem of actually getting it accepted and adopted. And that's just one example where reliability plays in. Yet when you back it up even further is, well, going back to the, if we just do the checklist, we're going to run a humidity test, we're going to do a vibration test, we're going to make sure that the UV doesn't destroy the finish, and on and on and on, the litany of, the, oh, we got to do an FMEA, and well, maybe we'll do a halt test. And here's the list of things that we always do as reliability engineers. You are probably going to get it wrong. You will probably have drones fall out of the sky, to use an analogy. Or that could actually be literally, right? But that's, I think, when you summed it up, that's what I got out of it. It's not, did we make them all the same? It's, did we make them well enough to be useful?
That's right. And in terms of, so the first two problems I talked about, one is a backwards looking two. It's actually backwards looking from a long time ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, it gets much worse because I think the mindset you're talking about, which is the third point I'd raise with compliance issues, is compliance is easy. It is easy to actually test something and say, yep, it passes or doesn't. It's really easy to stick a badge or a sticker on something. A
gold star. Yeah.
Exactly. That is really easy for us human beings to do. As a manager, if you're not really across reliability engineering, if it's not your strong suit, you sort of crave that sort of certification because then you can defend yourself later on and say, oh, it failed within the first one.
Yeah, we did these five standards and we passed all those tests. It must be good.
Exactly. It is easy. And I'll go one step further. Let's call it academically lazy. Yeah. So that's a third issue with compliance. It gives people an easy way out. And I include customers here too, because customers can be just as bad as the manufacturers. They say some manufacturers are frustrated by when they start or try to start having a conversation about reliability and risk with customers. And they say, don't care, it needs to comply with these 6,000 standards.
Right. Or is it UL certified? Then exactly. I know it. And it's, well, that has nothing to do with reliability. Or do you have a parts count prediction? Mill Handbook 217, my personal favorite.
Yes. It's insane.
Yeah. So there's, but compliance is just one part of not thinking about your product. There's one of the things that came out in the text of these articles, and I think it's still coming up in the series, is this idea that you can perfectly solve the wrong problem. I call that the type 3 problem, right? Or the type 3 error. Type 1 and type 2 are based in statistics and sampling. Type 3 is you're doing the exactly perfectly executing the wrong solution for the wrong problem or something like that.
That's right. So let's say the fourth thing, I mean, and that's Article 5 actually, which is title contains stop solving the problem you want to solve.
But I like the problems I can solve.
I know. Exactly. They're easy. So in the satellite industry, for example, we know, I do mean we, because the published analyses are out there, and once you discount the ones which are amateurish and incorrect, it is clear, and not many people know this, satellites fail almost exclusively due to infant mortality and deployment issues. And those deployment issues are what reliability engineers would know as dead on arrival failures. Those satellites that never once worked. And so for small satellites, we would expect for typical mission durations, that one in five would fail to ever deploy, be dead on arrival, and about one in six would fail due to infant mortality before the mission duration has been completed.
So you're talking 20 to 30%? 35% fail for dead on arrival and or infant mortality stuff.
That's right. So why that's important, because we just talked about solving the problem you want to solve, is if you look at every mission assurance guide, if you look at every design rule for satellites, they are virtually solving wear out failure mechanisms.
Well, they have a lot of redundancy and cast iron type bolt fittings. And I mean, it's amazing that how rugged and durable. They gotta, not for small satellites, but it's solving the problem of, well, it's like doing that temperature humidity tests for 1,000 hours. Well, one, there's not a lot of humidity in space.
Yep.
I think that's not really an issue.
Nope.
I don't know. Do things corrode in space? Is there corrosion problems?
Yes, there is oxidation. I mean, especially because you have oxygen ions in especially in the atmosphere for low Earth orbits and when they're deploying. So you do get that. Mm-hmm. You can defeat that relatively easily. And you do have things like polymer degradation, which aren't necessarily oxidation.
No, but you would have diffusion problems, metal migration problems.
Mm-hmm. You'd also have fatigue with the thermal cycling. The batteries are essentially, you know, same batteries you have in your smartphone, so them cycling up and down.
Well, they don't even work getting off the bus in New York, so in
the winter time, yeah. And you need to keep your satellite at certain temperatures, so you actually have heaters, so you have these thermal stresses going up and down. But the reality is that those things are really, those mechanisms, fatigue, polymer degradations, are extraordinarily easy for universities and others to put in a lab, study, and write 4 or 5 peer-reviewed articles about, which is how they measure their
success. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, but that's already done for you. You don't have to go do a long cycle test yourself.
Exactly.
In general, that's what I think your point is. Is that? But I think there's a piece of it is going, and we just fell into it. If you noticed, Chris, is that we started talking about the stuff we like to talk about, wear out failures and getting in the lab and running big tests and doing design of experiments on and extending the life, the useful life of the product. But all of that stuff we just talked about, cycle testing and aging and thermal stresses and so on, are wear out mechanisms. And
exactly.
You just said that 35% of the problems are up front, which
exactly.
are not Dead really related to that.
Yeah, so, I mean, without doing detailed root cause analyses, and you and I both know this, for infant mortality failures, we tend to look at manufacturing quality. We're talking about defects. We're talking about...
It's always the designer's fault. If they designed it well, we could make it well. You know, come on.
It can be designer's fault too. I mean, sometimes, you know, but
yeah.
we're talking about satellites failing because they deviate from some sort of baseline intended design, let's say that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which is actually almost an organizational problem. You can't model quality the same way you can model a fatigue crack growing over time and in beautiful test conditions. And because that's harder for us to understand and harder for us to impose standards upon, we don't. We just go to the easy thing, which is fatigue cracking and polymer degradation and those things, which you could argue have been very successful because we just don't see them ever.
Yeah, it's not a big problem. No, I think Kirk Gray had a argument that, you know, these cell phones, I think he used his mom in the article he wrote. He was his mom had a one of the original flip phones or mm-hmm. early cell phones, and the battery case was latch had failed, so it was duct taped on. She's from Texas, so the duct tape's readily available, and it still works fine.
Yep,
you know, did the job for her, does what she needs. And some would say phones are, you know, not really intended to last more than a year or two for the next model to come up. But if you don't need the latest, greatest gadget, I think her phone was working like 10 years now, something like that, 10, 15 years.
And that's,
you know, long beyond what I think anybody probably expected it to.
And she possibly handles it better than I 15-year-old school student as well.
That's true. Yeah.
So you'd have a look at the environmental conditions, but it's solving the problem you want to solve. What is it that you value?
Well, I think in the article you talk about it. I mean, it's look at the numbers. It's where are the Pareto analysis is the starting point, and then how much those cost you to get started, and for every industry, every new product, every kind of situation is a bit different, but it goes back to the first point. You got to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What is the problem if we solve it, or when we solve it, it actually makes a difference? What's got the best ROI for us here?
I'm sorry, Fred.
No, go ahead.
And these compliance frameworks that these small satellites are walking into are just so inappropriate for that purpose. Now, for example, if you look at the guidebooks and the mission assurance guides and the standards, it treats the satellite as the only system, only part of the system.
Mm-hmm. So it has to be incredibly reliable.
That's right. But small satellites, we now use the term constellations. Small satellites where you have a group of them performing the same task are called a constellation. So if you might have, for example, planet.com, their mission is to image every part of the Earth's surface at least once every single day. And they have about 200 small satellites in numerous constellations doing this. And we don't know how many of them are still working, how many of them are not. But that's beside the point. If one goes down, there is over 100 left to keep doing that job, and mm-hmm. then that you can iteratively, for example, launch more small satellites. Why I'm saying this is because having a small satellite with, or any satellite with a mission reliability, say, of 50%, might just seem, you might have an allergic reaction to that scenario. That's such a low reliability. There's a 1 in 2 mm-hmm. chance of it failing. But what if it's more cost effective to launch 4 of these highly unreliable small satellites than 1 very reliable satellite? I mean, 4 very small satellites, 50% reliability each. If you only need one of these things to do to complete the mission, then that's a 93% reliability.
Which is hard to do in a single device.
Very, very hard. And sometimes if you compare that to a satellite which has a 90% reliability, it might be much more cost effective to launch these 4 low reliability satellites versus this one single highly reliable satellite. And the standards and the compliance frameworks just don't allow that conversation to even start.
But that's, is that really just where you define the system? If the 4 satellites is my system, and do the current standards and thinking apply there? And the individual elements may be in low value. I'm just using redundancy.
Absolutely not, in my opinion, because the standards are very binary. It either is compliant or it's not, which means it's either reliable or it's not.
For a device. Individual element that's floating free in space.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
And this is where we, and again, small satellites are a perfect case in point. You might be paying, it might cost you as a customer between $1 to $2 million for a satellite, small satellite, to get into space. And in the satellite domain, that is nothing compared to the multi-billion-dollar projects required to launch those old behemoths into space. It is quite literally nothing, even though $1 million is a substantial amount of money.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if you have to impose all these compliance frameworks that were originally written for these massive multi-year, multi-billion-dollar projects, you would conceivably blow the budget and the schedule out by a factor of 3. So instead of having this small satellite now for between $1 and $2 million, you have this small satellite 2 years later for maybe $5 million. And this compliance framework is addressing problems which we know aren't relevant for satellites. And it's destroying business models as we speak.
Yeah,
so you have these startup companies are effectively choosing, do I comply with this mission assurance guide, which is being imposed upon me by a customer or by consensus, or do I just ignore it and build the satellite for this customer and argue to them, look, instead of paying $5 million for a single satellite that's gone through all this stuff, buy 3.
Save $2 million and you get it tomorrow.
Exactly. Kind of, and you get 3 of them. But even customers are very conservative in terms of what it is they're after as well. So it's once you start a thought train, it's very hard to turn that thought train around.
Well, that goes back to, I think, one of the overall gists of the whole series is you got to solve the right problems, and reliability is no exception. There's not a suite of tests. There's not a set of standards. It's looking at your particular industry, your particular circumstance and market, and make sure you're solving the ones that actually make a difference or make in reliability. I've had this discussion with various people over the years, is some will say you always do halt tests. And I'm like, well, no, think about it. If you already have a long list of things you know you need to fix, you don't have time. The halt's not going to give you a marginal benefit here. If you already had a past generation and you generated all this information, use that and move on. And on with every single test. If every activity we do, mm-hmm. if it's not going to be used, if it's not going to be relevant, if it's not useful, and I think what you're adding, Chris, is that it's got to be in context for our current situation. So using a standard, and I've talked about this situation years ago. It was these guys were making a little wrist monitoring, health monitoring type device you wear on a wrist. And their first thing was to look for, well, what standards apply that we can use to make sure that it's water resistant is one of the things they wanted to do. So they went and found all these different standards. They found a watch standard that says if we take the device and you stick it in a bucket of 3 foot deep water for 10 seconds, pull it out, shake the water off. And if it still functions, it passes. Mm-hmm. And they called out, you have to have 7 samples and blah, blah, blah. And they do all this testing. Every single sample failed in a week, but they ignored that because it passed the standard.
Yeah.
Right. And when they deployed their products, they shipped 50,000 units or so, and 75% of them failed within the first week because people got them wet. They washed their hands. They took a shower. They did whatever. It was meant to be used full time during your day, shower, swimming, whatever. And they failed in a week because of corrosion. Water ingress in and of itself wouldn't cause it to fail immediately.
Yeah.
Right? It took a week. And they proved it to themselves after that. But it was a classic of one, not thinking, how does this test really apply to the failure mechanisms that we're, are likely to happen or at risk to do? And they knew about corrosion, but they figured this test would solve that for them.
And there's, you know, example after example, for example, there's the pilot who was confronted with a landing gear issue, and that was the first problem that their plane faced. And mm-hmm. he was so consumed by that, having this landing gear issue solved before he landed, knowing mm-hmm. he could do an imperfect landing, he ran out of fuel and crashed. There's the, there is the Piper Alpha, which was an oil and gas platform in the North Sea off England, or off Scotland, more correctly. Mm-hmm. And for a number of reasons, one of the platforms blew up, and that itself is a case study. But there are a lot of neighboring platforms which were pumping oil to the inferno. And operators could see it, but they didn't think they had the authority to stop pumping oil.
Because that's so, driven you. Get every gallon or buck or a barrel of oil is money, so you keep pumping.
It was more just a fear of the hierarchy. It was just absurd. I mean, they could see this. They knew they were pumping oil into the world's biggest campfire, and they didn't do it because they didn't feel comfortable enough to go against practice. And this human psychology is a very interesting topic. I understand a few universities study it, but it really is amazing how you walk in and say, how on earth did you think this scenario was going to turn out? You got your security blanket, you got your, it passed the test,
rubber ducky,
got the star, but you knew it was going to fail. How did you possibly convince yourself that this was not going to be a bad news story?
And
talking about solving the problem you want to solve, the reason why I think small satellites are a really great case study for this issue is now we know it's dead on arrival. Now we know that it's infant mortality which is driving these failures. This drives how you build these things. Mm-hmm. We can't – the reason why infant mortality is an obvious characteristic of something that you build from scratch every single time. And that is what we see in the small satellite industry, or satellite industry more broadly. Mm-hmm. Every customer is treated as a brand new opportunity to build a brand new satellite. And sure, things are used from previous satellites, but they are truly not, you know, a slight modification of what happened beforehand. So what does that mean? they need to move away from this job production cycle. It won't never be mass production, but we call it evolutionary production. And there have been some interesting developments where, inspired by stem cells, animal stem cells, which when embryonic can grow into any sort of cell in the human body, and they're essentially circuit boards with non-volatile memory, and these circuit boards can do any number of things. And the idea is that you put 6, 10, however many of these on your small satellite, and you allocate tasks to each one. And if one fails, then everybody else changes what they do based on priority order. Thing can keep working. But what the pioneers of this idea failed to truly understand about what makes this a really good idea is that then you can produce this single, like, and they call it a cell, you can produce this cell time and time and time again for satellite after satellite after satellite, which means you're not reinventing the wheel every time you have a new customer, which means these manufacturing practices can be continually improved over time, which is one of the main benefits of mass production. With the volume of production, you can really improve the quality of your production processes. And so just by stop solving the problem you want to solve and moving to, okay, all right, infant mortality, dead on arrival, what does that mean? Straight away, it can tell you if your business model or your production model is wrong, and that's huge information. Yep. You can't approach a customer as if this is the first satellite you've ever built, but most satellite companies do. And just starting from a first principles approach, the first company that really embraces this, I have no doubt will start to dominate the world or dominate the industry in this space, because it was just going to realize so many efficiencies and have satellites that are orders of magnitude more reliable than its competitors.
Yeah. Yeah. And then instead of four, you could get by with two.
Exactly.
But you still, different thinking though, right from the get-go. So those are just a couple of things in this series of articles. And it is about small satellites, which is an interesting platform for the study. It's an emerging technology. It's reminiscent, though, as I was going through it, Chris, I was saying, oh, this reminds me of drones. This reminds me of autonomous vehicles. This reminds me of the first automobiles way back when. It reminds me of television sets and first cell phones and a lot of even just simple new features within a company or a generational improvement. There's still the same basic thought processes and items you're talking about in here apply. It's not just for emerging technologies. I think it's makes it an interesting read because it's a fascinating subject, except unless you're one of the people actually trying to create a large satellite these days, then it's going to be, oh, that's what we do. That's so silly. It might be a little frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned that there's 7 articles all together. I believe our plan is to have 2 articles out by now. And you find those at ascendoreliability.com underneath articles, and then look for the series. And I'm going to abbreviate it, Chris, as emerging technologies.
Yep.
And you find that. I believe we're going to move it under products development. It's out of the risk and safety block. I need to go ahead and do that. So you'll find it on the site if you search for emerging technologies. It's the easiest one. As a listener to the podcast series, and you've got access to the ebook that Chris is putting together of all 7 of these articles in a convenient one place for you to read those all. You don't have to wait for the whole series to come out online. And there you have access to it at ascendoreliability.com/go/think, T-H-I-N-K. And there you'll find a place to, if you're already a member of Ascendo, you can log in and pick up your copy of the series of articles, the small ebook on it, or you can certainly then register, which is free to do, and pick up your copy of the book and get it all in one spot. I'd say, Chris, it'd make a good Christmas present, but you'd have to have a really good person to send that to.
Yeah, anyone could take a joke.
That's right. But I think it has got some real great nuggets in it. And we'll probably talk about it again in another podcast, because there's some more gems in there we really should expand on. and talk about. So I'm looking forward to getting the whole series out and everybody's response and reaction to it. And plus, if you can't wait for the series to deploy over the next couple of weeks, go to ascendoreliability.com/go/think, and you can pick up the whole ebook that covers all 7 articles. So with that, Chris, I think we went a little bit long, but I think it was a fun, we probably should have broke it up into a even more segments, but be it as it may, that's what we got. And thanks for putting the series together. I'm really excited about the whole gist of the thought process you got on there. And I know it's going to be really eye-opening for some people and reaffirming for others that are like-minded. So that'd be great.
Absolutely. Might be a bit of a cathartic read for some.
Yeah, there you go. All right. Well, thanks much, Chris. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.